Good morning, everyone. Yesterday, I had a haircut after, I think, close to 3 months since the lockdown began. And it reminded me of the name of a salon in Goa many years ago. It was called Cut the Crap. And this is what the teaching does. It cuts the crap of the thinking mind, which is the ego. It cuts the involvement of the ego, the involvement that creates psychological suffering. That is the gift of this teaching. The ego loves to worship its problems, its perceived problems, its imagined problems, so that it has an identity, because it knows itself through that identity, the false sense of self. This worship starts coming to an end, so that one rests more and more in the presence or the conscious presence, which is right now. This reminds me of something interesting. About 15 years ago, I had gone to a place in Bombay, which many who are from Bombay would be familiar with, called Chor Bazaar. It translates as the thieves' market. And it is a market where a lot of antique shops are there, selling antiques and curios and furniture and everything which is old. It was quite a fun place to walk those narrow alleyways and streets, and one would see all these Victorian clocks coming out and doorknobs and various things. And I chanced upon a shop which had statues of Indian gods. And I walked in. And one statue really appealed to me. It kind of struck me from the corner of my eye. And I didn't know much about the statue, but it was a statue of Garuda, a small, maybe 1 foot high statue. Garuda is the vehicle of Lord Vishnu, the preserver. So I got it home because I really am very fond of that statue. It's like he's in a namaste position and his wings are behind like a cloak. So one day my friend came over, and he said, "Oh, it's a beautiful statue and it's all very well." But he said, "Do you know that this statue is flying all over your home in the night?" I said, "Are you serious? I mean, it's just a beautiful piece." He said, no, I can see the energy is restless and there's a reason." So I said, "Okay, because I don't know much about all these matters." So he said, "Garuda is the vehicle of Vishnu, and therefore he needs his master next to him for him to settle down." So I said, "Good Lord, so does that mean now I have to go back to Chor Bazaar and find a statue of Lord Vishnu?" And he said, "Well, you try. If you find something, well and good." So I went back to Chor Bazaar to the same shop, because I said, now who's going to really, you know, go all over the place? So I said, let's apply the law of least effort. Now, I didn't find a Vishnu statue, but I found a statue of the Buddha. And it was very beautiful, about the same height. And I thought it would be a perfect fit, because Buddha, after all, is the ninth avatar of Lord Vishnu. So now this time my friend came with me, actually. And so it was all effortless. So he said, of course, he's an avatar of Vishnu, so the energy of Garuda will be fine. I said, I'd love to have a statue of the Buddha. So that settles that, you see. Now, again, out of the corner of my eye, I saw a very beautiful white marble statue, but I did not recognize it. It was a man on a horse. Quite unique, that statue was. I hadn't seen it before. And my friend looked at me looking at that statue and he said, are you planning to buy that? I said, it's very beautiful. If it's reasonably priced, why not? He said, don't. I said, why? He said, because that is the statue of the Kalki Avatar. The Kalki Avatar is the 10th and final avatar of Vishnu. So I said, but why did you say not to buy? He said, because you see, the Kalki Avatar comes when the world is immersed in chaos and destruction and confusion. And so to worship the Kalki Avatar means that you are also calling forth. You are also worshiping, in a sense, chaos and destruction and hatred and all that stuff. So he said, generally, it is not a wise idea to worship something which comes after all this. You see, the point I'm making here is, what are we worshiping? What are we worshiping in our minds during our waking state? What is in your mind is what you worship. Is it thoughts of hatred, malice, jealousy, envy, guilt, blame, condemnation? And all thoughts of separation. Because if that is the content of one's mind, that is what one is worshipping. That is what the ego does. And that is why we have the masters whose teachings, whose presence is there for the taking, for the asking, given unconditionally. Yesterday, we were doing a test call to see if everything was okay, me and the team of volunteers. And I was mentioning to them that below my laptop are some real spiritual heavyweights, because my laptop is propped on books, you see. The first being the Bhagavad Gita, according to Paramahansa Yogananda, which I haven't read, but it's there in the house. Someone had gifted it to me. Then comes two of my favorite books of Ramana Maharshi, Talks with Ramana Maharshi and Guru Vachaka Kovai. They are both equally fat. You see, I have to bring a balance so that the laptop doesn't tilt left or right. And then the perfect balance I found was Eckhart Tolle's A New Earth. And next to that, another book which I haven't read, which is Osho's book on the Buddha. So after much research, I managed to achieve this balance. And then I added a book on Anandmahima, which we have published recently, a most beautiful book. For those of you who are into understanding the traditional guru-disciple relationship, and for those who have heard of Anandmahima, this book is a treat. It took us about 3 years, if I'm not mistaken, to bring out. And it is stories of a young girl who was young when she was with Ma in the beginning. She grew up to be a Bollywood film star and then transformed into a Swamini, Swami Nityanand Giri. So she has written her stories with Anandmahima, the incidents. Anandmahima, you see, was the highest of the high. She was considered an avatar by many. She was revered by all. And so, thanks to a devotee of Ma, who came up with the money to sponsor this project, it's a very beautiful, large format, full color production, hardbound, and many, many photographs of Anandmahima, because she was a resplendent spiritual beauty, you see. You can just see light emanating from her face and her form in any photograph that you see. So the author was quite keen that there are many photographs throughout this beautiful book. Anandmayi translates as the bliss permeated mother. Now I will share with you an interesting incident in light of the teaching. To put it into context, as I said, this is an expensive production. Now, if we were to price this book based on the normal parameters, it would have been too expensive for the people to buy. So, as I said, a devotee sponsored the costs, and therefore we decided we'll subsidize this cost. The intent was never to make money, neither for us, certainly not for the author, and of course not for the sponsor. It was to bring out new material on Ma and this beautiful intimate journey of Swami Nityanand Giri with Ma. That was the intent, because you can imagine a book 3 to 4 years in the making. What? How can you cover these costs? Forget the material costs. Now it so happened that someone called our office and said to my staff, why is this book so expensive? How can you charge so much for a book? Don't you understand spiritual teachings you're not supposed to make money from? How dare you do this? You see, this is what happens, which is the involvement of the thinking mind of the ego. Supposing there's a book which one wants to buy and one realizes that the cost of the book is high. A decision has to be made, can I afford it or not? Perhaps one can wonder why it is priced so high. But you see, for enlightened and awakened living, that is where the thinking mind of the ego stops. This whole story based on preconceived notions and ideas that, oh, spiritual teachings should not be charged for. Why is the book priced so high? How dare you? This observation and judgment is of the thinking mind of the ego, which doesn't even know half the story, but assumes it does. So we have to look at our own lives. Like, where do we stop? Do we stop at the facts of the case? Or is our mind involved in the duration of horizontal time, creating this whole should and should not be drama which is playing out in our own minds, passing judgment upon judgment upon judgment, and completely losing sight of the fact that the reality may be a completely different picture which we cannot see? This is how the ego indulges, and as Rameshji would say, more so the spiritual ego. More so the spiritual ego. So in one's own daily life, in your own life, during the day, see what are the thoughts related to the facts of the case, and what all have you unnecessarily overlaid as thinking in the duration of time. Eckhart Tolle gave this beautiful example of the weather, you know, how people incessantly grumble about the weather. So what could be as simple as it's raining turns out into this whole story that I hate the rains, why should it rain so heavily, everything is a mess, this is really too much, I don't like Bombay, I'm going to leave Bombay. That is the involvement in its raining. One may not like the rain because we all have our preferences, you see. The preference may be for no heavy rain. But the matter ends there. In enlightened living, the matter ends there. This whole drama of how things should be, should not be, and the complaints, which is the favorite pastime of the ego, is complaining. Because it again derives its identity. I am the one who is complaining because I don't like what is happening, you see. So that is another way to catch the ego. How much of it is invested in complaining? When one starts looking, just simply looking at the dialogue of the mind through the day, not doing anything, just witnessing it, that starts creating this shift, because then the mind and its antics are recognized. That is all that is needed, that this is how the thinking mind of the ego operates. Nothing more needs to be done than that. Nothing more. And this brings about the dimension of witnessing. Now I would like to touch upon two emails that I received, and then after that we can open the floor up for any questions. Love for the country and spirituality is the topic. Gautamji, I am a bit confused as to what is happening at the border with China. It is disturbing me. I love my country, and these actions are disturbing. But do these borders exist in the spiritual world? Should we be worried about our country, city, neighborhood we live in, etc.? Isn't the entire world our own? How do I overcome this anxiety? You see, I chose this not because of expressing any viewpoints on countries, politics, and so on, but the whole issue here is of borders and boundaries, which I'd like to take a few minutes to explore. After all, borders and boundaries are created by the ego, which separates it from the whole which separates it from others, which separates it from situations in life. Borders and boundaries come from the thinking mind of the ego. I must protect myself from the other. You see, there are two kinds of protections, one could say. Biological protection and psychological protection. Now, in the animal kingdom, we all know that the animals mark their territories. They mark their grounds, their hunting grounds, to make it clear to the other animals of the same species, don't come. It's an instinct. But that instinct is a biological instinct of survival, not a future-based issue of what could be, what might happen. You see, the Native Americans, I believe this is one of their sayings, which is most beautiful. You know, we are all fighting over, this is my land, that is your land, that is my land. So the saying goes, the land does not belong to you. You belong to the land. But what has the egoic mind done? Made it my land. Did anyone ask the land? My land. My possession. Did anyone ask Mother Earth? This reminds me of the story, which some of you might know, of the swan and Siddhartha Gautama, the prince before he became the Buddha. You see, his cousin shot with an arrow a swan, and Siddhartha ran to the swan, saw it wounded, and took it inside the palace to look after it. The swan was healed, and now a fight broke out because the cousin said, it is my swan because I shot it. Give it back to me. And Siddhartha said, it is my swan because I took care of it and healed it. And so this conflict arose. So they went to the king. King heard them out and he said, look, the answer to this is extremely simple. Both of you go and stand at the opposite ends of the hall. And he told his guards, you place the swan in the middle. And he said, whoever the swan goes to, it belongs to him. Now, who do you think the swan went to? So the swan was asked, you see, that is the main thing. And boundaries came about because obviously the earth has no boundaries, it's nature. Because the egoic mind, no matter how many centuries ago, had an aspect of aggression, invading people's lands, taking over their cultures, threatening them. So as a form of defense, the boundaries came up. Please understand what I'm trying to point at here is not this physical aspect of countries. It is ourselves. It is within ourselves. When we grow up as children with our conditioning, we are threatened by the outside world, which we feel is out to get us. And then we build all these walls that separate us from life. That is what happens. As within, so without. What is within is manifested outside as boundaries. Now, imagine, just imagine for a moment if all cultures around the world, whichever geographical part they belong to, were allowed to bloom and flourish the way they were, if there was no egoic wanting and greed superimposed on them, one could say that would have been a beautiful world. But it is not, because it is an aspect of ego. Countries far away invaded countries in those years when only ship was the mode of transport, because they wanted more. The egoic identity of the country wanted more, so it felt it could invade other countries. Domination and control aspects of the ego came forth. And this has been going on since time immemorial. So Advaita cannot give an answer to this question, simply because what it does is it allows you to think and feel exactly that which you should think and feel, based on the way you want to. But it explains this aspect of borders and boundaries, and it would be logical that if one had a culture, an enriched culture, which one loved, it would be logical to not accept that that culture would be a threat. And a sensitive person would wonder, why even does someone want to do this? And the nature of the human mind is exposed. How long will this go on? How many centuries will it go on? Till there aren't enough awakened people on the planet. The Leela will go on. But in our daily lives, let's look at all these boundaries which we have built, because that is something we can exercise some discretion over. Investigate a bit. Look at things objectively. That would be a great first step, you see. That is why Nisargadatta Maharaj would tell people who were into social service. He said, first clear your own mind. Go and look after the environment by all means. But what about your internal environment? What about what goes on inside your mind? If everyone did that, it would be an awakened world, you see. In fact, he was quite harsh. I have put it pleasantly, but I read somewhere that he told an activist that you think the world needs saving, but it is the world that needs saving from you. You see what he was pointing at. Are you abiding in your being? Are you resting in your being? Or are you totally identified with name and form as a separate entity and have created now this character who is identified with saving the world, saving the environment, and so on? So that is what the masters show you, you see. Look within, look deeper. Clean up your house first. Peace of mind. That is the gift. The second one I picked up because it was very cute. It had a sense of innocence to it. I will read it out first. I think it's a mix of Hindi and English, so I'll first read it out the way it is, because it actually stresses on an important point. And then I'll mention it in English. So the person says, सपोज फॉर एग्जाम्पल हमारी फैमिली में कोई इंसान है विद इन द फैमिली और आउटसाइड द फैमिली वट एवर वी डोंट लाइक दैट पर्सन एंड यू नो ड्यू टू फैमिली टाइज वी हैव टू झेलोफाई दैट पर्सन बी गुड एंड ऑल दैट हाउ डज दिस अफेक्ट आर कर्मास एज इन लाइक फॉर एग्जाम्पल आर इन लॉज इट्स जस्ट एन एग्जाम्पल नथिंग पर्सनल वी डोंट लाइक दैट नेचर But still, we have to be good. We have to fake it. It is nothing dil se. Matlab, dikhwana karta pade. To hamare karam ban jate hai. What should we do? How do we take it further? Dikhawa bhi na lage aur karam bhi na bure ho. Suppose, for example, there's someone in the family or outside the family, whatever. We don't like that person. But due to family ties, we have to be good to that person. How does this affect our karmas? As in, for example, with in-laws, it is just an example, nothing personal. We don't like their nature, but we still have to be good. That is, we have to fake it. It is not coming from the heart. But we have to show. तो हमारे कर्म बंद जाते हैं डू आर कर्मा स्टॉप इफ वी डू दैट व्हाट शुड वी डू हाउ शुड वी टेक इट फर्दर दिखावा भी न लगे मीन्स आई डोंट वांट दिस शो एक्चुअली एंड आई आल्सो डोंट वांट द कार्मिक कॉन्सिक्वेंसेस ऑफ दिस बेसिकली डू आई फेक अ रिलेशनशिप एंड प्रिटेंड एवरीथिंग इज गुड व्हेन आई डोंट फील इट फ्रॉम द हार्ट Basically, that is it. The answer is do exactly that which you think and feel you should do. But there are two things to look at. Are you at peace? Are you at peace? Has the understanding happened? That your in-laws in this case are not the doers of their actions. Have you accepted that they have come from their own conditioning, their own programming, their nature, and do and say things that they do and say? You don't have to like them. This teaching is not about embracing the world and each and every person in your life. But have you accepted them for who they are and for the way God has made them? If not God, the source, the divine, call it what you want. Because if that acceptance is there, then even if you put on a show, there is no suffering inside. You see, that is the whole point. But if you are suffering inside and putting on a show is painful, which in many cases it is, how long can it go? And the whole point here is that the spiritual teaching has come your way to show to throw light on relationships. That is why it is there. So you can fake it till you make it. You can do that. Siddharameshwar Maharaj said that even if you don't understand all I'm saying, you just keep saying, I am Brahman, I am Brahman, I am Brahman, and you'll become Brahman one day. What is the content of your consciousness in the waking state when it comes to your relationship with your in-laws? That has to be looked at. As I said, that is the worship. What is the point if the dialogue of the thinking mind stays exactly the same as it used to be. And one has to start faking not only one relationship, because it won't stop at one. All relationships are aspects of oneself. So if one is faking it in one relationship dynamic, the chances are very high that that faking is going on in different degrees across all relationships, you see. Because if one relationship in life helps iron out a particular emotion, let's say blame. Now I have the understanding that it is pointless blaming anyone, and blame itself does not make sense. And you are blaming one person in your life all the time. With the understanding on blame, you will find that in all your relationships, there is no blame happening. Because the issue of blame has been resolved. The issue of blame, the content of your own consciousness, has been addressed through investigation, through a teaching you have been drawn to, and therefore you have understood the concept of blame. And therefore, in all your relationships, whether it is colleagues, whether it is strangers, the issue of blame would have been resolved. So each issue is reflected across all relationships. It is not possible that you're only faking one relationship. That is something to be looked at. Now tell me, when you accept that everyone is an instrument of the divine, it actually means that you have started looking at everyone not from the eyes of duality, but the eye of singularity, from the heart. Then it is dil se only, it is from the heart only. Because it is the heart of consciousness. Okay, let's see if there are any questions. Yes, is that Amit?
Yeah, hi Gautam.
Hello Amit.
Hi, deep regards to you.
Thank you.
Gautam, I would like to ask a question regarding the realization and the suffering. Like, can a deep realization change my suffering? Because, you know, once I have realized something and I'm working upon myself completely with my heart and fully, you know, I'm witnessing my thoughts as well. So that realization leads to the acceptance, pure acceptance, and that acceptance also lead to the surrender. And as you mentioned that, you know, the gurus are always there to grace upon you in that pure surrender process. So can that be a change, or even after that, a deep realization, I have to face according to my prarabdha or my karmic baggage?
You see, Amit, the deep realization brings about an end to psychological suffering. That is what it does. But the prarabdha or the suffering one has to go through, let's say it could be a financial loss, it could be the loss of a relationship, and so on and so forth. Basically, whatever happens in your life over which you have no control, that is what is destined to happen. The realization ends your thinking mind and the ego's investment in that event. So it is the end of psychological suffering. That is the beauty of the teaching.
Okay.
Okay.
But this if you know, in term of, you know, relationship context, if I'm facing the, I can only work upon myself, and I can only, you know, witnessing my words, action, thoughts, deed. How do I deal with the other person if from the other side, a person is, if I'm facing the hatred and action and reaction and the blame and the vindictiveness of the person, then how should I deal with that?
You see, this is something which you have to decide on. As Eckhart had said very clearly, either you accept the situation or you don't accept it. Now, once you accept it, you have two choices. Either to work your way through that relationship in the light of presence, or to walk away if it is unbearable. You see? So definitely you are only concerned with your reaction, your thought processes, because you cannot do that for the other. But if you are the witnessing presence, what happens is you don't perpetuate the action-reaction loop in the relationship like a tennis match. That is what happens. You stop playing the game.
True.
As the witnessing presence. Now, once that happens, there is potential for that relationship to be transformed, because the other person sees that the ego is not being fed anymore. One ego is not being fed anymore by reactions.
True.
So that brings about a transformation which is possible in the relationship dynamic. If that does not happen and you find yourself at the receiving end and it is unbearable,
true,
then a call has to be taken. Can I suffer this relationship anymore, or do I walk away if that opportunity is there? So it is a very pragmatic teaching, you see. It doesn't make you feel that everything is going to be bright and glorious and beautiful. But as you so rightly said, you are concerned with yourself. That is where the work is to be done, as Aurobindo would say.
True.
Okay?
Yeah. Thanks a lot, Gautam.
Thank you. Yes, Pradeep.
Hi, Gautam. So, I have one query.
I cannot hear you. It's a very soft...
Is it audible now?
Yes, now it is.
Okay. So, I have one question in context of desires. What I observed in the past few days when I started observing the thoughts and desired, there is some desire that comes in and unknowingly I start taking some action onto it, only to realize after a few moments that, oh my God, this is not I wanted to do. So what I observed is how I can, you know, work on this so that there is some breathing space in between to, you know, decide whether to take some action or not. There are some desire where I get that space to decide whether I want to do some action on it or not. But there are some others wherein, you know, I observe that I don't get, you know, that breathing space. And eventually I land up working on those only to realize that, you know, I don't want to work on those.
Yes. So Pradeep, what you have raised is, I think, many people's question on desires. And you have already answered it, because you have said that you get the space as far as some desires are concerned.
Yeah.
That space means that the desire which has arisen is witnessed. One is not carried away with the desire. And what you are saying is, in other instances, that gap is not there. The witnessing presence is not there. And one is getting carried away with the desire. Am I right?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. So the first step has already been taken by you. which is you are already aware that there are some desires which you are getting carried away with. Now the ego asks, what is it that I can do to not get carried away by those desires? And the answer, Praneet, is nothing. Because what happens with witnessing, even if it is only some desires that are witnessed, it means the quality of witnessing is already there. The desires which are hardwired into our actions are the ones you are grappling with. Once again, you have to allow the witnessing, which will seep in sooner or later into those desires as well. Because you see, it is a process that cannot be reversed. Witnessing cannot be reversed. The point is that the ego wants that it should happen throughout, so I don't get carried away with any desire. That is the wanting of the ego. The ego wants to now be in control so that it does not get carried away with the desire. And the desire is the ego, you see. So it will never find something to do to stop this. It is witnessing which will stop it. So you will not get an answer, a true answer, if an answer says do this or do that to stop getting carried away with certain desires. Allow the witnessing to do its job. It is already so beautiful that you are aware that there are certain desires, when I witness, they go. You literally can see the desire come as a wave, a physical wave. And when it is merely witnessed, it drops away. But with some desires, you get carried away. It can literally be seen. So that awareness itself is enough. Do not try to hasten matters, because that can create suffering. The intent is good, that I would like this to be with all desires. That intent is there. Many people are so blind to their desires that they are not even aware. They are just on autopilot and on a mode of fulfilling all desires, many times to the detriment of others or themselves. You see? But the gift of the spiritual teaching is this quality, this very fine quality of witnessing, is emphasized more and more and more. And you will find automatically that your involvement in those desires is not harming anyone, not harming others, not harming yourself. It is a process. It may not happen overnight, but that quality of witnessing will seep in there too. You see, because we must remember one thing. We do not suffer the desire. We suffer the involvement in the desire. Desires are desires. Based on our programming, our conditioning, a desire will arise. But it is the involvement in fulfilling that desire which creates the psychological suffering. So the desire is not the enemy. The enemy is the involvement in the desire. So it just has to be looked at not as my desire, but a desire arising in a body-mind organism which happens to be mine. So when you personalize it less and less, this desire, already that wedge is created between that desire and the witness. It is not my desire, it is a desire arising in a body-mind organism which happens to be mine. When you shift this attention like this, let's say from now onwards, you will notice, since you are already quite aware of other desires, you will notice how this shift does the job. That's all I would suggest. Okay. Ehsan.
Hello, sir.
Hello.
So, sir, actually, my question has been answered by you. It was quite related to what Pradeep asked. So my question was that sometimes while witnessing, it seems to me that the ego has taken over the role of a witnesser. And at times, the witnessing seems to be very smooth, like it is being done on its own. And sometimes it seems that the witness is like surrounded by all these huge energy of thoughts and it feels trapped. So, sir, when this kind of when this happens, when the witness seems to be trapped in the thoughts, energy of thoughts and emotions, sir, is it also the ego that is playing its game, sir?
Beautiful question, Ehsan. It is not the witnessed which is trapped. The witness can never be trapped. It is the ego that is trapped in the thoughts, and it is the witness that is aware that the ego is feeling trapped with the thoughts. Please understand this. It is the ego that is feeling trapped. The witness cannot feel. The witness is the witness. It is the ground. But who is aware? Who is aware that there is a feeling of being trapped with the thoughts? Who is that? That is the witness. So the witness is already there, always present. The ego is the one trapped with the thoughts. The ego is the one feeling the pressure. The witness will not feel the pressure of the thoughts. So as you rightly said, sometimes the witnessing is smooth. Sometimes I feel it is something to be done. That is the ego talking. So feeling trapped, which almost all of us feel trapped by our thoughts. But the sheer fact you are asking this question means you have thought about it, looked at it. Others have not. That is why some of us are drawn to the spiritual teachings. So that witnessing is not something you can achieve or attain. The witness is always there. What happens? In the absence of the one who is feeling trapped by thoughts, the witness is present. So you don't have to do anything to be a witness. The witnessing is already there. Anything you do is the ego doing. Please understand. If you are trying to be a witness, it is the ego that is doing something to try and witness. The mere awareness that there is a feeling of being trapped by thoughts. There is a feeling of being trapped by thoughts is witnessing. I am being trapped by thoughts is the ego.
And so sometimes it also seems that ego is the one that becomes sattvic also, like saying that, look at me, how, you know, how lucky I am that I am tracking on this path. And all of this is also observed. This usually, these were the things that were obstructing me initially, because I was, you know, I thought that this is me that is doing something. And all these sattvic feelings, and I didn't know that I was actually falling in the trap of the ego itself. Right. But now you have made it so clear that there is nothing to be done to be a witness. It is just, you know. And thank you so much for the clarification, sir.
My pleasure.
Thank you so much for the clarification, sir.
But what happens when witnessing is the quality of sattva gets enhanced, you see. The rajas and tamas get reduced. Mind is no longer churning and spinning dramas and stories and cartwheels. That's what happens. But it is not my mind is getting sattvic. My thoughts are getting sattvic. That is the ego. Okay, that was a beautiful exchange. Thank you. Yes, Pragati.
Morning, Gautam sir.
Morning.
A few months back, I took out the diaries that I wrote over the years, and the last oldest one dated back to 98, almost 1998. So I was going through them, and I realized that the dialogue in all the diaries didn't change one bit. The stories didn't change, and all that I'd read over the years, all that I had understood over the years, was like a waste of time for me, because I found no change in my thoughts at all over the years. I tore up the diaries that day, all of them, and decided that it's about living the teaching now. It's time, to change the dialogue. And that's after that, I kind of found you. And now it's been about little things, the daily living, basically. And I'm in a fix right now with the disciplining aspect of my kids. Because on one level, we know that we cannot control anything. But on the other, when you see the kids, I would say that I've been the most undisciplined child myself. So it's hard for me to actually discipline them, because I've tortured my mother more than they're doing to me right now. So I don't know where to draw the line. I can't understand where to start and where to stop.
Yeah, actually, Pragati, it's very simple. You see, a child's parents are the child's first gurus, because they are the ones looking after the child and showing the way for the child in these years. So therefore, as a parent, you have to do exactly that which you think and feel you should do, because you, after all, are the parent of the child. So your buddhi comes into play. The problem is that you are second guessing yourself. Am I doing right? Am I doing wrong? Am I not doing enough? See, that is what happens. Because as Rameshji would say, that parents need to realize that the child comes with their own destinies. Many parents don't realize that. They try to force the child down a certain way. You see? So if you feel that I need to bring out a degree of discipline in the child, all you can do is try your best. Thereafter, the results are not in your control. So this is how the teaching operates, by accepting that, just as you rightly said, you were not a disciplined child, that was your destiny. And now you feel that you should ensure your children don't turn out like you, so you're trying to discipline them. So try it. What happens with parents, I have seen this often, is that they force their views onto children. They repeatedly force things onto the child. And that is when the child starts becoming a rebel, you see. So this teaching is not going to tell you, don't discipline them too much, don't this, do that. You will not get those answers here. You can be sure of that. But this teaching allows you to accept that your viewpoint is also limited at the end of the day, because totality as a whole is bringing up your child. The conditioning your child is receiving, not only at home, at school, with friends, with the people the child is in touch with, is bringing up your child. You are one aspect. So all you can do is what you feel you should do, knowing that excessive control can create a lot of problems, a lot of problems. You know, in our case, it was exactly the opposite. I lost my father when I was 14. So after that, my mother brought us up. And you know how the teenage years are. It can be very difficult for a single parent. Never once did our mother say no to us. I have not heard that word no from her lips. And do you know how disciplined I turned out? That's the joke of life. Isn't that amazing? Okay. Yes, Rahul.
Yeah, good morning, Gautamji. This is an honor to ask you a question. I've seen you only on YouTube. So you are my first YouTube guru, I can say.
Oh, God. I don't know if that's a compliment.
No, actually, I've been watching a lot of spiritual videos and somehow I ended up watching your channel and I subscribed. And very recently, actually, I started watching your videos, but found them to be very peaceful, I would say. I mean, a sense of peace I could get. Gautamji, my question is not philosophical or spiritual, but more more materialistic, you could say.
Thank God. That's real, you see.
So it's about fear. And I'm at a crossroads now professionally, and I have a chance to do something I like, but which is a little difficult. And I have a chance, I have another option to do something which is safe, which, you know, I can get regular pay and I don't have to worry about the future. Not really worry about the future, but it's basically computer science, IT and all that, you know, that. How do I choose? And how is this fear a part of my ego or this insecurity, or is there a better purpose of my life by doing something which I like, which I know I'm good at? That is my question.
Which, Rahul, I will help you answer it. I cannot provide you the answer. Of course, you see, what is fear? Let's keep it very simple. All fear, as the Buddhists say, is the fear of death. All fear eventually is the fear of death. Will I survive if I make this transition from this comfortable job, which is safe, which is secure, to doing something which I would rather be doing because I would enjoy it more, but perhaps it may not make me that kind of money? Why? Because if I don't make that kind of money, I will find it hard to survive. This is how fear operates. Now, this fear of death is not the fear of the death of the body. This fear is the fear of the death of me. Does this fear exist in deep sleep? Doesn't, right? So this fear is the death of me. I am afraid to die. If I change my job, chances are I'm not successful. I won't earn that much. And that will be the death of me. Please follow what I'm saying. It may sound dramatic, but we have to get to the root of this fear. Now you ask yourself, how badly off would you really be if you changed this job and things didn't work out? Okay, perhaps you wouldn't live the current lifestyle, maybe a little less. Then maybe it's worth taking that leap. But if you feel that, no, my chances are zero once I abandon the current task, and I fail at the new one, no one will hire me back, and I don't know what I'll do, and I'll be finished, then you have to think twice. But what this teaching does is it throws light on this fear and makes you ask yourself this question, that is this an exaggerated fear? You see, because the ego has been structured on fear since childhood. So this fear now, this fear which is getting in the way of taking this decision, is now witnessed in the light of clarity. Okay, let me look at this fear. Let me understand it, where it comes from, what are the implications of the fear? And you will find that a distance is created now between the fear and the witnessing of the fear. And then you will reach this decision yourself, this decision of whether to take the leap or not, because now you have understood. You have understood the issue of fear in relation to the job. So allow this to sink in. You see, I had mentioned this once many years ago, I think 15 years ago, not when I was giving talks, but one incident related to fear which happened is there was a moment of fear. And I sensed this energy shoot up from the Muladhara chakra, the base chakra, from the base of the spine, you could say. And it shot up. And I was so fully aware of it, I don't know how, in that one instant, that there was no delivery taken of the fear. It did not get delivered into me. I don't know if that makes sense. And then I saw the energy drop back down. It came up, there was no delivery taken, and it dropped back down. But then I realized that with fear, what happens is the psychological fear, that energy of fear, which is purely biological, you see. You have to have biological fear because otherwise you would be crossing the road blindly. It is the biological fear which makes you look left and right and then cross the road. But what happens is that biological fear has been taken hold of by psychological fear. And that energy of fear, which is a biological moment, gets trapped now because I get afraid. Me and my story needs to be kept alive. And I become fearful. And then that fear starts consuming me and consuming me and consuming me. So if you accept what Ramana Maharshi says, what is destined to happen will happen, try as you may to prevent it, and what is not destined to happen will not happen, try as you may to make it happen. Therefore, the best course is to keep silent. And by keeping silent, he doesn't mean talking less. He is talking about the silence of the mind which is full of fear. What will happen to me? So with this understanding, after this talk, sit back, enjoy your coffee or whatever it is you like, nimbu pani, and look at this fear regarding the job and rest in the assurance that the decision you take is what you are destined to take. It is no longer my decision. It is a decision taken in the light of clarity where I have looked at the fear quotient and component regarding this job switch I have to make. And keep that decision at the feet of the Lord. Okay?
Thank you. Thank you.
We'll take, I think, one or two more. We have too much of a backlog of questions, but I think we are running out of time. So we have, is it Tesh?
Yes, Gautamji, it's Tesh. It's my first time with you. It's about 10:30 in 11 o'clock in Seattle night. So yeah, I'm just happy to be here and in this. So thank you for doing this. And so in the interest of time, I'll straight go into my, my context. I first got attracted to this by listening to, Rameshji, and something in his voice kind of sounded like, a little bit like my father, except he made me, my father, who just died a few months ago at age of 99, he used to make me miserable. But Ramesh made me feel happy somehow, you know, kind of, you know, it's like in this country, people say off the hook, you know, as if my dad was always got me on the off the hook, you know. I did awful, Baba, I mean, what you call, you know, at work, don't you feel ashamed getting drawing salary and not doing your work? I feel like even more, you know, back there. Sorry, I'm trying to make this short. So somehow I feel like in the relationship with my parents has always got me on the hook. I'm not saying all Indian households are like that, but that's for me, and my sister would disagree, I guess. But somehow listening to Ramesh-ji got me felt I'm off the hook. It's an internal feeling that I could, you know, breathe. And I know you talk differently, but I feel some relaxation from you also. So but my question is, what do you think about the doership that I did do this good, I did this do bad, you know? It's just like every kudos that I give myself comes with a lot of shaming, you know, or put down. You know, it's just like all the kudos that I give myself, I kind of dressed as put down. And in this country, people want to be proud, but pride and shame are kind of like a huge amount of duality anyway. So I know the way you speak also, you're great in your own rights, but in light of what Ramesh-ji said about doership and whether I really did it or not did it, and even he talked about taxi driver, like, for example, you know, I tried to do my career change, but somehow I couldn't push back to my computer job and a software QA. I'm bored and I'm still back to doing that. I know some taxi driver got really mad coming to see him because he didn't give him, you know, tips to change his profession or something. So anyway, that's too many questions. I just want to introduce myself. Thank you. Anything you want to say?
Well, Tesh, you see, the thing is that there's no room for pride in this teaching, because pride means I did something. Whereas what this teaching hopes to show you is all your attributes which enable you to do something which turns out well are given by God. So pleasure will certainly arise because, you know, you reached a goal or something has happened which makes you happy. But there will be no pride as it is my action, because you now know that there's a whole stream of forces and events which come together to make an action successful. And in the same way, there is no room for shame in this teaching, because if you fail at something, you know that you tried your best according to what your definition of best is. But there were a whole host of factors not in your control which led to that thing not fructifying. So you will never feel shame because you know it is truly not my action. My action is based on my genetics and conditioning, over neither of which I have any control. Plus, there are so many other factors which brought about this event that I call a failure. So regret may arise. I put in hard work, yet I didn't get the result. But there is no room for shame because it is not my action. So you see, this is what happens with the teaching. There is no pride and arrogance, not my action, and there is no guilt or shame, not my action. The result is we are no longer swayed between these polaric opposites of these highs and lows in life that we experience. We reach a calm center where we know now that all I can truly do in any situation is try my best. Thereafter, what happens is God's will. And now I also know that not only what happens is God's will, but whatever I am doing is also God's will, because it is based on my genetics and my conditioning, over neither of which I truly have any control. And then I accept this. I start flowing with life more gently. You know, it's very interesting. My wife, Devika, she practices something called bark flower remedies. It is a natural remedy based on flower essences, which a gentleman in England had created. So for various ailments, they prescribe, you know, certain essences of flowers, which you have to take a few drops every day. Now, she was telling me that they have one essence, which is not from a flower. It is called rock water. It is water which is collected from streams which have flowed over many, many rocks. And that water is given for people who are facing, or rather who think they are facing, various obstacles in life. So to flow like rock water, water which finds its way around the obstacles, over the rocks, is given as an essence to that person to ground them, to make their life flow. As Rameshji would say, let life flow. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I say, go with the flow like H2O, you see. And when the sense of doership is reduced, one notices that one starts flowing with events and situations. One no longer attributes them to me, me and my story. One gets more neutral about happenings in one's life, and therefore successes and failures are no longer overlaid with attachment to them as outcomes. They are accepted as the flow of life.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you so much. Okay. Where is the rock bottom? Can I get it here?
Rock bottom? I think Google it, or there may be bark flower therapists in the US. It's quite interesting, and what I like is it's natural.
Wow, yes.
It's natural.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I think we'll have to stop here because we've run out of time. So there are a few hands up I can see, which we'll take next time. I'm sorry about that. I'd like to add one thing here. There is a talk being scheduled at 9 p.m. next Saturday, also an additional talk. This is specifically for about 8 to 10 passages I'm going to read out from a book which is quite popular in the West in spiritual circles called A Course in Miracles. It's a very fat book. It does not appeal to many people in India because they are not familiar with the language. You know, language like words like Holy Spirit and salvation. But I found these passages represent the highest teachings of Advaita. And I would like to present them in context of peace of mind in daily living. So if the timing suits you all, 9:30 p.m., not 9 p.m., apologies, 9:30 p.m. India time, next Saturday night. Sunday morning will be our usual talk. A newsletter will go out regarding this talk on A Course in Miracles. If you are on the mailing list, you'll receive all the details with the links to Zoom, YouTube, and Facebook. And it is not at all necessary that you have had to read that book, but you will find that this teaching is actually universal. When you hear it in different words from what I have been talking all along, it might open up a new dimension, a fresh perspective. So please do join if you are inclined to next Saturday. Let me see everyone. Consciousness is such a mystery. It seems I'm so far away from y'all. But when you look at me, my image and my voice is arising in your own consciousness. That is how close we are. Can it be a more intimate relationship than that? And not just me, all the people in your life, not only those you love, but those you don't love, they are all arising in your own consciousness. Their voices are arising in your own consciousness. Isn't it so obvious that it is everyone's experience, and yet we stick labels on people and we call them names? Look at this Maya. Look at the illusion. Look at the divine hypnosis, as Rameshji would say. You didn't do it. Don't take responsibility for it. It is the way the ego is structured and designed by consciousness. But now consciousness has given an invitation to look at things in the light of clarity and understanding. And its gift is a deep peace and tranquility and calm, accepting one's lot, accepting that whatever has come into my life unasked is what is meant for me. Sometimes pleasure, many times pain. That is life. You think your life is not fair. Joan of Arc, as a young girl, as she said, heard the voice of Archangel Michael in a village in France and said, go and help the king fight the war and win. And this young girl picks up the sword she finds in the field. And she goes, she leads army upon army, wins battle upon battle. And eventually, she is caught, handed over to the enemy, and she is burnt at the stake. And she asks Michael when she's on the pyre, I followed your command. You put that voice in my head as a young girl. I did what you asked me to do. And this is where I end up. And then it struck her that obviously even this has to be your will. And then as a last request, she asked for someone to stand afar and hold a cross high up in the air. So that would be the last vision she saw, because now she accepted this too is God's will. This too is God's will. And we complain about such petty things in our lives most of the time. This fire of understanding will burn away all your delusions. It won't be easy. Nobody said the spiritual journey is easy. But all that is false will be reduced to ashes. And the light of consciousness will shine in its radiant glory.